Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. About a third of the way into this book, I started making a list, and I realized that every person I love is on that list to receive this book. It's called Love 2.0, and it's one of the best books I have ever read, A Map for Living Life. Dr. Barbara Fredrickson is our guest, and she's giving us scientific research on love that is life-altering, useful personally and professionally. It's a new way of looking at love, of understanding love as connection to others, whether it's intimates we're talking about or strangers. So these are questions. How are our brains wired for love? What do brain imaging techniques tell us about how we change for the better when we tip into our capacity to love, to connect? It's possible, without much work, to increase our ability to embrace the world and each other, to rewire the brain to connect to others more and more. I give this book the highest recommendation I can give a book, Love 2.0. Its author-scientist, Dr. Barbara L. Fredrickson, is the Kenan Distinguished Professor of Psychology and Director of the Positive Emotions and Psychophysiology Lab at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She is also author of Positivity. Many people know that book. Barbara Fredrickson, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You write that love is different from what you thought. What did you once think it was?
Well, I think like everybody else, I think of it as, falling in love and finding the person that who's your soulmate and getting married. And, I certainly still have a special place for my husband, even though I am looking at love at all different angles. But, I think that I am, and like most people, actually there's a worldwide poll that says that most people take love to be that one special relationship. And I think that that is blinding us to the ways that love really is experienced in a micro moment of mm-hmm. connection. And those micro moments of connection are what knit us to the most important people in our lives, but they're also what connect us to community and to our neighbors and friends, and they're kind of like the tiny engines that keep it all running.
In doing your research and studying the data of other researchers, what is love? You keep using the word connection through the book.
Right. One thing that I should disclose is that I'm an emotion scientist, so I look at things through the lens of emotions. And in this book, I'm actually taking what I see as the best of relationship science, looking at the science of relationships and the science of emotions and bringing them together, and looking at love as a momentary state that rises up and affects, two or more people at once, kind of rolls through two or more brains and bodies at once. And is that sort of energizing moment of connection where you share a common source of positivity, you share a very interesting biobehavioral synchrony that emerges between two or more people, and then it's also a sense of mutual care. When those three things are together, that's what I'm calling positivity resonance, and I'm suggesting that those micro moments, because the data show us how important they are for our health, may be a better, a more practical definition of love than as a status of a relationship.
Mm-hmm. When you were first talking about it in the book, I thought, are you saying, and I learned, of course, that you weren't, but, are you saying that a kind of loyalty or commitment to a relationship long-term doesn't matter? It's these passing moments that really count. You're not separating those two things.
No, I think the way to think about it is that we use the word love for so many different things. We use it for a feeling of passion. We use it for a feeling of connection. We use it for commitment. We use it for loyalty. We use it to signal, that we're married, different ways. So if you step back from that, you can see sort of a larger love system. And I think these micro moments are what account for our feelings of trust, loyalty, and commitment, or feeling of bondedness. It's not that one is replaces the other. You know, those, it's, you know, trust, commitment, loyalty, long-term relationships, still super important, super vital for our health. But creating an eye for the importance of these micro moments of connection helps you see how you can keep your bonds and commitments strong and healthy.
Let's describe what this looks like on the ground. So you're on the plane and you notice the two people in front of you in the seat. You understand from overhearing them that they've never met before, and they are practically nose-to-nose engaged with each other, telling a story. And they're both in it, you can see, and this energy is going back and forth, no matter who's doing the talking.
Right.
That's one of those moments.
Yes. Yeah.
Grocery store bagger. An encounter, a postal person comes by, you have somebody's walking a dog, and you have that moment. Sometimes it's just someone giving a look, that passing look where you have a kind of smile and you both know we've just connected with each other. That's what
right.
you're talking about.
Right, exactly. So these states that we might, you know, overlook or even think of as trivial are actually ones that really fuel our health and help both you and the other person become better versions of yourself, especially we're finding in terms of physical health.
The last thing I thought would happen to me is that my two new friends that I made would be five. You know, these twins, and they're 5 years old, Maddie and Gabe, and I you know, ran into them and I started to connect with them, and I notice that I listen even more carefully. I think of myself as a careful listener. I listen even more carefully now that they've become my friends. And I see that these little looks that they give, they seem to be sweeping by, but then our eyes will meet. And it is profound, this connection that we have. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking about it. This can happen intergenerationally. It doesn't
right.
matter how old, how young,
right.
what circumstance.
Right, right. In fact, you know, infants are arrive on the scene totally prepared to engage us in this way, you know, through eye contact and just following each other's gaze and staying connected. And parents interacting with their infants when they have this sort of positive engagement and attunement going on, what researchers have found is that they're not just showing this sort of nonverbal dance where you can see the connection in the synchrony of their movements. They also show a synchrony in their biochemistries, especially in oxytocin.
Yeah. Can we talk about that? Because I was going to ask you, what happens in the brain when there is this shared moment of connection, no matter how fleeting it is?
Right. Well, there's some very intriguing new neuroimaging evidence coming out of Princeton that in Uri Hassan's lab there mm-hmm. that shows that when people are really engrossed in conversation like the, you know, the one that you described and that you're witnessing on the airplane, you know, when people are really engrossed in listening to each other, they show very widespread neural coupling or a mirroring of neural firings. This is not just in one isolated mirror neuron area, but across the whole brain there's surprising coupling, so much so that it's led researchers to conclude that speaking and listening are not two different brain activities, but that communication is one brain activity that happens across two brains at once in synchrony. And this is even more so when people are sharing emotional information. So when people are really connecting and understanding each other, there's a synchrony going on at the neural level as well as the physiological level and the nonverbal.
How amazing that we can now see this. Isn't that something? It's a call-in show on this book, Love 2.0, by research psychologist Dr. Barbara Fredrickson, who is director of the Positive Emotions and Psychophysiology Lab at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We invite you to tell us a story about a moment of real connection with someone you know or a stranger that made you feel life was better for that moment. I'm talking about spontaneous exchanges, maybe a purposeful commitment to be present for someone, a passing look of recognition. 203-776-9677, 203-776-WNPR. Barbara, it's interesting that you know when one of these moments has happened.
Right. I mean, I think at one level we've all known it, but we've never been able to really, you know, describe it in concrete terms. And, you know, taking a scientific lens on it, I'm not trying to, you know, be a killjoy about it, but it just, what I think this scientific appreciation of these moments can do is help us elevate them and prioritize them and know how absolutely important they are, you know, against the backdrop of kind of contemporary life, which pulls us to, you know, stay so busy focusing on achievement and getting things done on our to-do list and, you know, or connecting through technology instead of face-to-face.
Well, what about that? Say right at this moment, somebody has a smartphone out and the person is either speaking by voice, texting, doing video with somebody. That is a form of connection. But why is it different from the kind of connection you're talking about?
Right. It's definitely a form of connection. And it's also definitely very frequently a source of positivity. You know, people can, you know, laugh and feel inspired and all kinds of things by what they get through social media or computing or on their phone. Mm-hmm. But what's missing is the synchrony of two or more bodies and brains kind of connecting over the same thing in real time. And it's in a little bit, it's kind of like the sound of one hand clapping or something. I mean, it's like there's connection, but it's not in a way that's reverberating and echoing back. Now, I should say, face-to-face isn't the only way that these connections can emerge. Mm-hmm. Shared voice is certainly very powerful because the vocal tract carries a lot of information about emotion in real time. And video chatting could get part of the way there, although it's often difficult to make proper eye contact through video chatting because the camera's in one place and the picture's in another. So, and researchers have found that eye contact seems to be a key gateway for getting mimicry going, and the facial mimicry and neural synchrony seem to go together. And so it's almost like people don't really come to have the same feeling at the same time unless there's sensory co-presence in some way, and that could be through shared voice or face-to-face.
Barbara Fredrickson, stay right where you are. And what we're going to talk about in a little while is how you can increase your capacity to connect. Maybe you're someone who does this easily. You can do it more. Maybe you're someone who thinks, I'm not very good at that. We're going to tell you some exercises to do to increase that capacity. We'll be right back. Faith Middleton. Join the conversation with us on Twitter at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR, where you'll find our lineup of interesting guests for the week. We are talking with Dr. Barbara Fredrickson, who has done this extraordinary book, one of the best books I have maybe ever read. It's called Love 2.0. She is a scientist, a research a psychologist and runs as director of the Positive Emotions and Psychophysiology Lab at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And the smart thing she has done is to reposition, based on data, brain imaging, the idea of what love is, how we look at it, how we define it, how we use it, and is redefining it in terms of those micro moments of connection with another instead of that sort of all-encompassing romantic love sense. Not that that doesn't matter, but to increase these micro moments of connection with people you know and with strangers, she is positing, will make for a better life in terms of your sense of richness and in terms of your actual physical health. John Faith Middleton with Dr. Fredrickson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I had one of those moments. It was about 1973 or 74. I was working as a high school student at Brown's Market, and John Downey, if you remember him, grew up in New Britain, was in a Chinese prison for 20 years, mm-hmm. solitary confinement, and he was released. And he came home, and he came to the market, and the butcher gave him a big steak, his sister I waited on. But as he left the store, and I didn't say anything to him because I didn't feel like, you know, bothering him like being a pest, and he flashed a look with a smile at me like, hey, thanks, kid, and I appreciate you respecting my space. But it was a connection that I'll never forget.
Huh. Dr. Fredrickson, that's one of those passing moments. And I think, John, you're saying it's not because he was, you know, quote-unquote famous at that moment, but that there was something that happened in the air. Are you getting that, Dr. Fredrickson?
Yeah, it's a nice example of not necessarily somebody with whom you have a relationship, but it's you have a human connection and you're recognizing that at that moment. And, you know, guess what? Our, you know, human bodies respond to that in a healthy way.
Thank you so much, John.
I will say that I also have a friend who is enormously wealthy. And when he talks to you, when you're like at a party with him, you feel like you're the most important person in the room. He has this way about him, the way he carries himself, that he makes you feel special. And I wonder if there's a connection to his success that has promoted that.
When you're talking with your friend that you just described, is he looking at you? Does he make intense eye contact with you? Gives you the sense that he's hearing every word that you're saying?
He would lead you to believe that he is so interested in what you have to say, but he doesn't make you feel like he's burning a hole in you either. He's very comfortable,
yeah.
But he just makes you feel special.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if that might be part of his key to business success.
It could
making
be.
People feel special.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Okay.
Well, first, Dr. Fredrickson, I'm interested in your response to that, and then I want to ask you something that's generational.
Yeah, well, it definitely can be part of what makes people kind of masterful in social situations, and in so many areas of life, that's going to lead to, you know, opening doors for success. So it's very possible.
There's a thing that can happen on the internet where there's a way to flame somebody, to say something critical, by describing that person as an emoticon. And the idea there is, oh, see, this person is either showing or discussing emotion too much. And we've had a psychologist on the show, Dr. Nancy Horn, who said she sees a difference in generations, that some people in recent generations can, it's not that they don't have the feelings, but they don't like to talk about them publicly. Whereas old school boomers, hearts on the sleeve, talking about emotion all the time.
Right.
So, you know, what about that?
Well, it is interesting. I mean, I've heard descriptions of, you know, younger generations as the edited self. You know, mm-hmm. that since we can edit every presentation that we have of ourselves on our, you know, social media mm-hmm. or text, or, you know, we don't have to respond in real time with our full humanity and our emotions on our sleeves. And so I think there's a way in which, I don't know, you can get out of practice, because we do have a biological capacity to connect, or to be better or worse at making these forms of connection. And, you know, just like our, you know, physical strength, it's kind of, it obeys a use it or lose it kind of phenomenon here, where if people aren't exercising their skills of real-time connection, you know, human-to-human, face-to-face, then they a little bit erode their skills for connecting. And actually, the upside of it, though, is that there can be an upward spiral here. The more you connect in these ways, the better, the more biological capacity to connect you have, which is also very closely related to your physical health. And so it's kind of a win-win upward spiral dynamic where the healthier you become in the terms of this biological capacity, the better your skills are.
So we invite you to tell us a story about a moment of real connection with someone that you know or a stranger that it made you feel that life was better in that little spontaneous exchange or a planned commitment to be present with another person, a passing look of recognition. 203-776-9677. Cynthia, Faith Middleton with Dr. Barbara Fredrickson.
Hi, Faith. Great. I love this show.
Thank you so much.
I just want to say, when I was 17, I was living in Hawaii at the time and working, and I had met a girl with a brief meeting in a bathroom, believe it or not, and she said, I just had to meet somebody. Let's say a week later, she introduces me to this man, and then for a moment, I thought I felt like I've known him my entire life. Now, the moment that it was a very brief encounter, it was just a few minutes, you know, we talked, he left, you know. Years went by. I actually come across him again, although I had always thought about him. Long story short, he gave me my one and only son, who's now 18 years old, and that was it. Like I said, I felt like I had known him my entire life, and it's probably because I knew he was going to give me the love of my life. And that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you. I thank you so much for saying that on the show. I appreciate it so much. Dr. Fredrickson, this is... this gets at the ability to recognize that there is something happening, that sort of shared sense of importance.
Right. I mean, I think there's a way that comes with this where, you know, you feel more alive, you feel more awake, more attuned. And, you know, those subjective feelings that go with these states of connection actually seem to be pointing us towards health and becoming wiser, more resilient versions of ourselves. And it need not be these really high-intensity moments like the callers have described. I mean, in positive psychology, we found time and again that it's the frequency of these kinds of positive moments, positive connections that matters far more than the intensity. So the intense ones are the ones that are perhaps the most memorable, but it's the frequent repetition of the mild connections that seem to be the things that, you know, drive us steadily towards health.
You talk in a biological sense about the vagus nerve, which should be the name of a club in Reno, I think. why is the vagus nerve important?
The vagus nerve is actually very fascinating because it's the 10th cranial nerve that connects your brain stem to your heart and to other internal organs, and it's the main player in your parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calm and connect part of the autonomic nervous system that counteracts the fight or flight side. And it's especially interesting because it's closely connected to both physical health and to social well-being. And one way that scientists measure the effectiveness or the functioning of your vagus nerve is to measure what's called vagal tone sometimes. It's heart rate variability. It's a very slight variability in heart rate that's associated with your breathing, such that your heart rate speeds up a little bit when you're breathing in and slows down a little bit when you're breathing out. And that's described as the most efficient way of distributing freshly oxygenated blood to your body. Now, people have thought of vagal tone as very stable, kind of like your adulthood height. And it's important because it's linked to cardiovascular health, glucose regulation, immune regulation, and also some key psychological skills, like the ability to regulate your attention and your emotions and be socially skillful. And what we find is that if we teach people ways to self-generate more micro moments of connection in a daily life, they actually show improvements in vagal tone. Again, this is something that past researchers had thought was very hard to change, and we find that it changes in step with the accumulation of these mild and frequent moments of positive connection. So it's an objective marker of health that shows improvement with connection and actually establishes our biological capacity to connect.
This makes me think about depressed people who are in a kind of insurmountable fog, or at least that's what they say it feels like. And everybody's had moments of depression, so you get a glimpse of it, except for people who are clinically depressed in a major way. This goes on. And, you know, it can be hard for them to believe in increasing optimism because the mind they need to envision that as possible is stuck.
Yeah.
It's a dirty trick.
It is. It is. And especially because one of the things that I've argued in the book is that, you know, although we like to think of love as unconditional, as you know, that's kind of a key ideal that we have, these micro moments of connection don't emerge no matter what, regardless of conditions. One of the key preconditions is that people feel safe. And we know that people who are depressed, anxious, and lonely find that a lot of their day feels unsafe. And so when people feel unsafe, they can't venture into feeling okay connecting with another person. They're more worried about threats and staying safe and protecting themselves. And so one of the key things to work on is to try to expand the amount of contexts in which people recognize their safety, because most moments are safe. The things that make us unsafe are usually, or make us feel that we're unsafe, either happened in the past or we're worried about some possible thing in the future, when, you know, in the present moment, the way I like to put it is, well, right in the present moment, who's putting pins in your eyes? Usually, probabilistically speaking, the present moment is actually safe for most of us.
And you write, you know, in this way in the book, that feeling isolated can do more damage than being isolated or disconnected. That sense that you are, it doesn't even actually have to be happening. Let's take a call. Jason Faith Middleton with Dr. Barbara Fredrickson. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much.
Welcome. Go ahead.
So I've been thinking about what you've been talking about, and I've been going through some different situations and experiences in my life, and I've noticed that I've experienced these moments with people of different sorts, and it has made me wonder, what is the relationship, or is there a paradox between these microcosms of experience of love and the phrase opposites attract, because it seems as though the phrase opposites attract is kind of a paradox, since these moments of these microcosms of love are related to similarities that you find.
Yeah, you're asking, I think, a good question, which is, do you have to be like-minded to feel a sense of connection? Dr. Fredrickson, what do you think? Thank you, Jason, by the way.
Yeah, well, I think it's kind of interesting because, you know, where I think connection can happen most readily is when you see yourself as sharing a common humanity or looking at your similarities. So although at a surface level there may be some opposite or differences that, you know, can be intriguing and interesting, it's like, oh, I want to learn more about what you know because I don't know anything about that. But at a core level, you know, we all share the same nervous system and the same capacities to connect. I mean, you know, there are exceptions for people who have had major brain damage or other things, but, you know, there are more places where we are far more similar, you know, in terms of what we appreciate and value.
I was at a party, and I was sitting at a table full of, let me see, about five men. We could not have been more opposite each other. These were, and I had the best time. And you know, they ended up saying, let's all go out drinking together. And I said, oh, well, that's a great idea. And, you know, politically opposite, everything opposite. Mm-hmm. And it was such, and we all had it. We all had this connection with each other. It did not, there are times when it does matter that you're opposite on a spectrum. This was just one of those things. I think everybody knows that feeling where no matter where you stand, there's something that happens between you.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's openness, isn't it?
Yeah. Openness is a real key. And, you know, helping other people feel safe and respected in that context is also real key. And I think just one of the aims I had in writing this book is to help people develop a set of lenses through which they can see these interactions happening around them, you know, between other people and in their own experience, so that you can steer yourself more towards them.
Let me ask you, this is going to seem challenging in a way based on what you just said, but you're in the real world situation and you encounter someone new and your radar, your gut says, be wary.
Mm-hmm.
What do you, you know, studying positive emotion and being so interested in this, what do you do with a situation like that?
Well, you know, I think there's very good reason to trust our gut instincts. There's, in fact, you know, not everybody, for example, not everyone who might smile at us is smiling at us with sincere affiliative intent, you know, or for our well-being. They may be trying to manipulate us. They may be just simply so wrapped up in their own enjoyment that they're even oblivious to us. And one of the things that research has found, which I think is absolutely fascinating, is that, yeah, we do have a gut wisdom about what people mean when they're smiling or when they're approaching us, but we actually can't access that if we don't make eye contact with them. And that when we make eye contact, we mimic another person's facial expression, and if they're being manipulative or insincere, we can get a gut sense of that by how it feels to have smiled that way. Of course, this is not happening at a conscious level. This is something that, you know, just contributes to our gut intuition. What the researchers have found, and this is Paula Niedenthal's work at University of Wisconsin. It's really a fascinating work on the, she has what she calls a simulation of smiles model, that if people don't make eye contact and or are in other ways prevented from mimicking another person's facial expression, we're cut off from that gut wisdom. So, and if you can think of here, so many times we misunderstand what people mean through social media or emails or texts. We can even misunderstand if we aren't directly making eye contact, if eye contact is severed in some way.
Yeah, we were very interested in what you're talking about. Marianne LaFrance at Yale University doing research on the smile also. Just so fascinating to think about what's communicated in that expression. When you see faces on the news, on television, on the street. Please, Barbara Fredrickson, stay where you are. We're going to talk about having more control over your biology than you realize and practices that can make you able to connect more easily. Stay right where you are. It's time to take a stand. Brothers and sisters, join hands. We've got the let love rule. Let love rule. We got the let love rule. Let love rule. Divine Faith Middleton, thank you so much for joining the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Also wanted to thank our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol, production assistance from Josh Allen. Our guest, Dr. Barbara Fredrickson, so smart, a research psychologist professor. And she has been asked twice to present her findings on positive emotions to the Dalai Lama. This book, her new book, Love 2.0, is fascinating and important. We'll take a call and then talk about exercises to increase the ability to connect with others in small ways and in big ways. Charisse Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.
So I thought it was fascinating how you say that this is something that we can practice and get better at. I come to this sort of idea from a very different background from meditation. And what you're doing in meditation is precisely trying to eliminate the barriers between yourself and others. Some of your guests have said that they've had this one experience maybe 30 or 40 years ago. And I found that one way to increase your ability in this is actually to sort of practice it with either infants or even non-human animals, pets, because they don't have the same kind of barriers up.
Well, that's actually a great idea. And our guest, Dr. Fredrickson, talks about connection on all levels with all kinds of animals, right, Barbara?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think at one level, all mammals kind of share this capacity to, certainly we wouldn't own pets if we didn't feel, that our cat or our dog, when we look in their eyes that, there's something going on there. And, some people say that their pet gives them unconditional love. And I would point out, it's like, well, actually, it's conditional on you have created a safe environment for your pet. That's why they treat you in such a, connected and loving way. If you hadn't have treated them well all that time, it would be a very different relationship. So in some sense, it's not necessarily unconditional, but it's a great example. I did appreciate the caller, Charisse, mentioning meditation. Actually, the research that led me to this reformulation of love was actually my nearly a decade-long research program on meditation, and particularly a form of meditation called metta, often translated as loving-kindness meditation. I was inspired to do research in this area because of some great work by the Mind and Life Foundation, where they're Mind and Life Institute, where they're focusing a lot on mindfulness meditation and how that kind of mind training changes people, and then became acquainted with this different form of meditation that really is all about cultivating warm and tender feelings towards other people, and what it's led to is to help me see that as a mind training technique that really allows people to prepare themselves for connection in daily life and be more open to it.
Mm. Thank you so much, Charisse. I really appreciate it. You've opened the door for us to talk about this kind of mindfulness, these insight moments, these little micro moments, I think you call them, Dr. Fredrickson.
Yeah.
So in this ironic world, we have the Saturday Night Live version of this, which would be people walking around with smiles plastered on their faces, ready for connection.
Right.
And so in the sense that you mean this, how do these loving kindness moments work?
Well, I think it's just a mutual sense of caring and respect for one another, and it doesn't need to be this over-the-top, insincere interaction. In fact, one of the things that we are as humans is inherent insincerity detectors, in that, we know when somebody's just, taking it too far. So, this isn't, but, there's a phrase that I really like is that there wouldn't be such a thing as counterfeit gold if there were no real gold somewhere. So, there's ways in which people distort this, fake this, kind of use it in a different economy, but we shouldn't, in getting cynical about that, we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater and miss out that actually there is a very important form of sincere connection that we can create with other people.
Yeah. How does this, you have exercises in the second half of the book that are just terrific. And so this loving kindness micro moment, we'll call it, you know, some people would call it a little meditation. What does it sound like? What is it like to do one of these? And how does that work on the brain over time?
Right. Well, these are ancient mind training techniques that have been developed over millennia. I actually created several versions of them that dovetail nicely with the science that I put on a website that accompanies the book, which is at www.positivityresonance.com.
Positivityresonance.com.
Yeah, thank you. And the classic pieces of these meditations are very simple. It's a set of four wishes, you know, where you either offer them to yourself or to someone else. May they be safe, may they be happy, may they be healthy, may they live with ease. Now, it's not like there's magic in these actual sentences, and people are actually encouraged to change up those sentences in ways that evoke as much openness and positivity as possible. And so what you're really trying to do is to prime prime those feelings and not just focus too much on, you know, mouthing the words. But those classic phrases draw us out of ourselves, out of our cocoon of self-absorption, to pay more attention to others and to actually care about what's going on with them. And, you know, meditation practices aren't magical thinking. They're practice. They're just ways of giving, you know, exercising that attention and awareness towards other people. And the more we do that on our own, kind of privately, the more when we're interacting with people in our day-to-day life, this is what our studies show, that people are more primed to connect, and they do report that each interaction they have with a person later on is more uplifting, more joyful.
Yeah, this is a little bit harder for people who have a sense that they're introverts and, you know, feel they've come into the world this way. For other people, it's a little bit easier. So if you're you tend to be an introvert, does this kind of practice that you're talking about make it easier for you?
Yeah, and we actually find that it works as well for people who are extroverted or introverted. There's not very many personality differences that seem to be ruled out in terms of, you know, what I say for all of these different practices of learning how to self-generate positive emotions and positive connections, they can help you become a better version of yourself. You may not go from being the most, you know, introverted person to the most, you know, outrageously connected extroverted person, but you'll become more connected relative to your own baseline, and that matters. That, you know, so you're kind of living at the top of your range, and that, you know, those kind of changes really do have an effect on people's health and well-being.
And that's documented, health and well-being.
Yes, yes. Yeah. These are, we've looked at changes in vagal tone. We're currently looking at changes in gene expression in the immune system. So there's every reason to suspect that we'll find effects there, because there's a long-standing research program on loneliness and changes in gene expression. Mm-hmm. So if we can kind of look at the positive side and see how it connects there too.
You know, the line that is delicate here is the one where people who find out that they're ill in some way can then say, well, if I'd just learned to be more positive or open to this kind of positivity, I wouldn't be as sick as I am. Hearing these words, and what do you say to them?
Well, there's, you know, this kind of scientific information shouldn't be used to, you know, either blame oneself or blame another person for their health. So many things contribute to health that it's one of these areas that is, you know, outrageously multiply determined. And but a perspective on positive emotions can, you know, take you from wherever you are today to, you know, just feeling more alive and at least enjoying life and potentially putting you on a more positive trajectory of health. But maybe, you know, again, it's not a it's not like you go from being the most ill person to super healthy. You could just be, again, within the limits of what you can change. Our emotions are something that we do have more control over than we think.
One of the things that I see frustrating people who try meditation is that they want some kind of early feedback or proof that it's working.
Right.
And I try to explain this as dieting. If you're on an eating plan, you don't look down at yourself and say, well, there go 3 ounces disappearing.
Right.
You can't,
exactly.
You can't tell.
Yes.
You just stick with the plan, and then all of a sudden you notice over a little bit of time, oh, something's better.
Right.
So I guess these meditations like that.
Yeah, meditation, it's very much like a lifestyle change. I mean, we found that you can change your habitual positivity over time, but it is something that takes as much effort and impulse control as would dieting, losing weight, or lowering your cholesterol. You can't just say, tomorrow I'm going to start having positive emotions, you know, kind of nonstop. It just doesn't work that way. It is something, it's a steady kind of habitual mind training, heart training, if you will.
Wait a minute, maybe you can. What's that stuff that they sprayed on people? What would they give them? A nasal?
Oh, an oxytocin nasal spray. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah.
You know, there's some interesting science that comes out of that. We're actually doing some of it ourselves in our lab. But I think it helps us understand, you know, how biology is involved in this. But, I think that we certainly have plenty of natural sources. having these micro moments of connection is probably a better source of oxytocin than a nasal spray.
So. Like eating real food instead of taking supplements.
Exactly.
Joyce, as quickly as you can, we have a couple of minutes, Joyce.
Hi. I'll echo a couple of things. 40 years ago, I'd been practicing transcendental meditation for 4 years. And I was listening to a radio station one night and heard a DJ. I immediately said, I love this man. I have never met him before. I called him up. We had a relationship on and off for 15 years. Huh. He ended up as a White House reporter. I ended up with pictures of myself and Reagan. We both were positive for each other, and it was a feeling of, it was a recognition that I was in love with this man from some other time in space.
Yeah.
And it was incredible.
Yeah. Well, I think Dr. Fredrickson is saying, I mean, good for you. Dr. Fredrickson is saying that maybe not your soulmate, but that feeling, that moment of connection with others is possible in so many ways, so many times in a day.
I hadn't thought about meditation as being related, but I had been practicing it daily for 4 years up till that point.
Thank you.
May very well be I was open to it at that point for that reason.
Yeah, thank you.
Because I do it now.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So, Dr. Fredrickson, I want to let our listeners know that you talk about meeting another person's good fortune with love, about compassion, even in the face of suffering. And it's counterintuitive that you can move towards suffering. It strengthens a sense of compassion. The loving kindness meditation that we were talking about, these micro moments to practice. So good, this book and the work that you do. Thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Our great pleasure. The book is called Love 2.0. Dr. Barbara Fredrickson is our guest, and she says this about her husband at the end: just like our beloved ocean, my love for Jeff crests and renews endlessly, reinforcing our lifelong bond. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
That's the story of, and that's the glory of love.